Thanks for listening to Star Lores. If you like the show, please consider subscribing and giving a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also help us make more great content by becoming a patron at www.patreon.com. We would also love to hear from you on social media. You can follow Star Lores on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Enjoy the show, and may the Force be with you.
You are listening to the Star Lores Podcast.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Are you stuck up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder?
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
The Star Wars galaxy is full of political intrigue. On the heels of this intrigue comes war, fought on the galactic scale. These wars, and the political gamesmanship undertaken by such leaders as Prince Sejor, Emperor Palpatine, B.L. Octavius, and Leia Organa, is made possible only by faster-than-light travel. This fast transportation condenses the galaxy into a region which can be navigated within months rather than eons. Faster than light travel is the heart of the Star Wars. The politics of this universe cannot be understood without an appreciation of the scale and shape of the galaxy. To discuss Star Wars without mentioning the approximate size and shape of the galaxy is like trying to understand World War II without knowing the approximate size and shape of Europe and its states. Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn stated that most stars support planets with life. Extrapolating from this premise, life in the Star Wars galaxy is extremely abundant, as are civilizations. In fact, there may be billions of distinct sentient species, since there could be as many as 100 billion stars in an average spiral galaxy. We know Star Wars takes place in a spiral galaxy based on occasional graphical representations of it in various in-universe settings. Spiral galaxies are the most common galaxy morph in the observable universe. They contain a bright bulge in their center, which contains a much higher density of stars than is found in the disk and halo.
In the halo region of the galaxy is wild space. This region is largely unexplored by any known civilization. It is beyond the edge of the map, in other words. It is a place where dragons be. Galactic halos contain a lot of interstellar gas and possibly dark matter. Relative to the rest of the galaxy, this area has a low density of stars. Beyond wild space lies a grand void of unimaginable scope between galaxies, and beyond the void come horrifying creatures such as the Yuuzhan Vong.
Moving towards the core, but still hundreds of thousands of light years away, the next layer of the galactic onion are the unknown regions. They have been mapped, but not extensively explored or colonized. Anybody possessing hyperdrive technology could presumably travel to worlds in this region, but they would have no idea what might await them.
The outer circumference around the galaxy, at the edges of the spiral arms, form the region called the Outer Rim Territories. This region has many rugged, uncolonized, or frontier worlds, and frequently serves as a refuge for people who find themselves persecuted, exiled, and abandoned. Notable Outer Rim worlds include Tatooine, Ryloth, and Mandalore. Out here, the rule of law has traditionally been less effective than in more central regions of the galaxy, and many planets are sparsely inhabited by sentient creatures. It is the brutal, merciless, and violent frontier of the galaxy. The rotating disk of stars coalesce into beautiful spiral arms that contain gas clouds which can form into new stars, all orbiting a central mass in the center of the galaxy, likely a supermassive black hole. It is in this region of the galaxy that we approach the mid and outer rims. At some point prior to 36,000 BBY, a small number of species began to use interstellar travel and charted the major safe hyperlanes, thus connecting many worlds in an unprecedented manner. Distinct cultures communicated, mixed, and fought on an unparalleled scale, and the unique political landscape of the Star Wars universe was born.
The Midrim region of the galaxy encompasses the section of the galactic disk adjacent to the bright and massive Deep Core. It contains such important worlds such as Kashyyyk, Malastar, Sullust, Rhodia, Naboo, Ando, Trandosha, and Nal Hutta. Many civilizations here have had a contentious and bitter relationship with the Republic. The world of Uba was even the victim of what can only be called a war crime on the part of the Republic when they bombed all life on the world into extinction, and the Aqualish of Ando warred with the Republic after first contact. Around 20,000 BBY, cultures from the Deep Core colonized worlds here during the Great Manifest period. Until a relatively recent point in galactic history, this region was the galactic frontier, and was a refuge for the likes of space pirates and Huttese criminal organizations.
Life, and thus political groups and civilizations, first started in the Deep Core on worlds like Tython, Goroth Prime, and Coruscant. Tython was the ancient home of the Jedai, a culture composed of many different alien species which preceded the Jedi Order. Goroth Prime is the world where life in the galaxy first emerged. Coruscant is the planet on which humans first evolved. Conversely, the further out from the core of the galaxy, the fewer inhabited worlds there are, and the more porous the degree of political organization. It is hyperlanes like the Corellian Run and the Hydean Way which run from the edges of wild space through the core and out the other side which facilitated galactic trade and travel. A reliable mechanism of faster-than-light travel between star systems created a galactic setting in which empires and sprawling metropolitan democracies are born and die, locked in a struggle against one another in unending, millennia-spanning cycles. The second great cornerstone of galactic politics are Force users. Much, or even most, of the conflict seen in Star Wars involves Force users to some extent. The wielders of this mysterious power inevitably find themselves caught in galactic affairs as arbiters of destiny time and time again. An example of Force user influencing the political history of the galaxy is Sheev Palpatine, the Republic senator who would go on to become Emperor. Other notable Force-sensitive political actors include Leia Organa, Revan, Master Yoda, Alima, and Satal Kiddo, to name only a few.
Politics is simply the continuation of war by other means. Mand Alore.
The politics of the galaxy in Star Wars, like contemporary politics, bear the influence of colonialism. The earliest galaxy-spanning civilizations, such as the Rakatan Infinite Empire, used the unprecedented speed provided by Infinity Gates to expand their territory. In this expansion, the Rakatans colonized and enslaved the people of countless worlds, harvested their Force energy, and stole their natural resources. For millennia, these reptilian hulks dominated, enslaved, and literally consumed countless aliens and worlds like an intergalactic locust swarm, not to mention each other. This motif is repeated many times throughout galactic history by the Sith Empire, the Zygerian Empire, the Yuuzhan Vong, and the Galactic Empire. An important consideration in empire building, both in our world and the Star Wars universe, is slavery. This phenomena is broad and begins early, approximately 36,000 BBY, with the Rakatans, and continues in virtually every galactic empire that arises in the Star Wars universe.
This politics thing, it's all just a racket, right?
Marn Hieroglyph.
The Zygerian Empire, based out of the Outer Rim, was built almost entirely on the slave trade, eventually attracting the scorn of the Old Republic and the intervention of the Jedi. The Jedi liberated many of the slaves under Zygerian control, though the Old Republic and the Jedi were not able to abolish slavery from the galaxy entirely. There have always been individual worlds, empires, and regions where the slave trade flourished, even during the halcyon days of the Old Republic. Crime syndicates such as Black Sun, or those run by the Hutts, have always managed to keep the trade in sentient species thriving, especially on the more anarchic, sparsely populated worlds of the Outer Rim. Some swaths of the Outer Rim are known as Hutt space, such as the domination of these slime-covered creatures over the colonies there. The Republic, in most incarnations, has been ineffective in policing here. These planets have brutal histories and merciless traditions. Since the Galactic Empire was ostensibly an outgrowth of the Republic, slavery was initially illegal by their laws. However, all of the Republic's anti-slavery laws were eventually repealed or vitiated in unenforceable regions, such as Hutt space, and some species would be classified as non-sentient in order to make moral their enslavement. It is interesting that the Empire required moral justification in order to enslave others, indicating that perhaps the motivations of individuals within the Empire were not as monolithic as the Empire might try to convey. It would be more in keeping with the Sith political doctrines that underpin the Empire's political philosophy that any individual too weak to resist slavery deserves its shackles, sentience notwithstanding. Much of the Republic's war efforts after the Battle of Endor focused on slave reparations and the liberation of enslaved Wookiees. The efforts on Kashyyyk were undertaken largely thanks to Han Solo and Chewbacca, and these rebellion heroes would go on to become important leaders in the New Republic.
Spice is a psychoactive substance and major drug of abuse and recreation throughout the galaxy, and is commonly prohibited by governments. It is often closely tied to the illicit activities carried on by criminally exploitative organizations. The planet Kessel was a major source of spice and was mined in large part by enslaved Wookiees who often met their death by overwork in its mines. Other notable spice mine locations include the moons of Naboo and the Twi'lek homeworld Ryloth. The use of spice is frequently outlawed by governments. The consequences of its use and possession range from imprisonment to losing a military position and even death. As is often the case with the prohibition of psychoactive chemicals, its illegal status drives its value up artificially, making rich those brazen enough to trade in it, like infamous crime lord Jabba the Hutt.
The empires that rise and stay in power do so on the basis of military domination, focused on powerful weapons of mass destruction. These machines of war often have the capability of destroying entire worlds. Revan's Sith Empire used the Starforge to create its massive space navy, which brought the Old Republic to the brink of dissolution in 3963 BBY. The Galactic Empire made use of the Death Star, a moon-sized battle station armed with a superlaser powered by kyber crystals. Alderaan, a core world of political significance, was the only planet ever destroyed by the Death Star. In an attempt to resurrect the Galactic Empire, Emperor Palpatine, in a cloned body, had the massive new Eclipse-class Star Destroyer built. This titanic ship had its own less powerful version of a superlaser, but which could still effectively destroy most worlds, but not as completely as the Death Star's laser. At the same time, the remnants of the Galactic Empire also developed the World Devastators, massive machines which could quickly turn a planet's resources into new vehicles of war, both crushing enemies and creating more tools with which to crush. A final Imperial weapon of war is the Sun Crusher, capable of destroying entire stars and virtually indestructible. Though built by Imperials, a Jedi acolyte of Luke Skywalker's was the only person to ever use the superweapon.
Galactic civilization is ever caught in an ebb and flow between democracy and autocracy. As one style of government loses ground, or stars, as it were, the other gains. Eventually, as the political tide on either side are even, war breaks out. One government side wins out, and the cycle repeats, often violently, as is the case with the Jedi Civil War or the Galactic Civil War. After the Galactic Empire was toppled by its terroristic anathema, the Rebel Alliance, the democracy-autocracy tension continued. This is the case in both the Legends and canon timelines, in the form of remnants of the Empire and powerful moths vying to occupy the power vacuum left by the death of the Emperor.
The galactic political entity known by various permutations of Republic has been the dominant form of political organization in the galaxy for thousands of years. It has gone through three distinct phases, and the extent to which it exercises the powers of government over planets varies widely. Broadly speaking, member worlds of the Republic appoint representatives as senators on a capital world, and these senators convene to pass legislation and take actions which affect member worlds of the Republic. The first phase of galactic democracy is known as the Old Republic and dates from at least 12,000 BBY. After a series of devastating conflicts with the Mandalorian, Zygerian, and Sith empires, the Old Republic reformed as the Galactic Republic, starting the second phase of the Republic. The Galactic Republic phase saw a period of relative peace which lasted from 1000 BBY to around 22 BBY when the Clone Wars began. The Galactic Republic was then transformed by Palpatine's massive political reforms into the Galactic Empire in 19 BBY, which would itself be overthrown during the Galactic Civil War. In the economic growth and peace of its 1,000-year history, the Republic had become inefficient in maintaining order, and many of its senators were corrupted by simple vice and greed, or by more sinister powers like the dark side of the Force. Additionally, growing corporate interests began to usurp democratic principles, and senators would sacrifice the interests of their own constituents for their own personal benefit, or ignore the pressing local issues at the expense of the broader political ambience. And so the Republic fell, or rather was engineered to fall, and was replaced by the Galactic Empire. The Galactic Republic was a representative government. Individual worlds were represented by senators, appointed by whatever means a given planet chose to appoint their officials. The governments of the worlds that participated in the Senate need not themselves be democracies in order to gain membership in the Galactic Senate. Princess Leia and her mother, Queen Amidala, for example, were royalty from their respective worlds and were referred to by the appropriate honorifics. In the Senate, however, their power was not that of a monarch. Their power shared by all senators was in their individual votes for the Senate's actions and in their aptitude for political guile and gamesmanship. The Rebel Alliance began the third phase as the New Republic, as the dominant form of galactic government in 4 ABY. The New Republic moved their capital from Coruscant, perhaps to distance itself from the Galactic Empire's highly centralized governmental style and prevent the rise of future dictatorships. The capital thereafter rotated, based on the homeworlds of its senators. It never reached the galaxy-spanning size and power of its predecessor, though this was likely by design rather than a failure to emulate their predecessor.
In order to ensure the security and continuing stability, The Republic will be reorganized into the First Galactic Empire for safety and
secure society.
So this is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
The Galactic Empire formed from the corpus of the Galactic Republic. Like the Republic that preceded it, the Empire made the core world of Coruscant its capital. Executive power in the Empire was focused in Emperor Palpatine. As such, his death at the Battle of Endor hailed the hegemony's decay as various moffs, admirals, and others vied for power in the crumbling Star Empire's leadership. The Galactic Empire was organized in three primary tiers. The first is the Imperial Ruling Council, led by Emperor Palpatine, and staffed by Grand Vizier Mas Amida and other important Imperials. The second tier contains the Imperial Moffs, who functioned as governors of sectors of the galaxy, presumably encompassing trillions of citizens. Finally, there is the military tier of Imperial government, which carries out the bidding of the Moffs, imposing totalitarian rule over the galaxy. The Imperials exercise power through violence rather than consensus. This simpler organization and decision process facilitated greater security, efficiency, safety, and peace on a galactic scale, according to Palpatine's propaganda machine. The fact that the Empire engendered violent rebellion and lasted only a couple decades compared to the millennium of the Galactic Republic indicates that this streamlined authoritarian government does not lead to a safer, more peaceful society.
The apparent eternal struggle between galactic empires and republics is mirrored by the struggle between those who subscribe to certain philosophical and spiritual interpretations of the Force. The two easiest categories to examine are that of the Sith and the Jedi. The various galactic republics have owed their success in large part to the Jedi, while the empires have owed their success to the Sith. The Infinite Empire, though not necessarily Sith, shared an obsession with the dark side of the Force and the power that it gave them. It was an important ingredient in the eventual formation of the political doctrines and horrific force powers of the Sith Empire. Galactic theocracies have periodically risen in the galaxy. In 11,000 BBY, the Old Republic was turned to such a state with the ascendance of Supreme Chancellor Contus Pex I, a member of the Pious Dei faith. Contus Pex initiated a centuries-long period of crusade and conquest by the Republic. Eventually, a descendant of Contus Pex was arrested and removed from his post as Chancellor by the Jedi Master Bail Duck Davis. The Jedi withdrew again from politics once the Old Republic had recovered from the damage inflicted by the Pious Dei era. In 5000 BBY, Naga Sadow led the first of several Sith galactic states. Each time a Sith-led state is emerged, a galactic war has followed, with the power-obsessed Sith usually being the instigators of such conflicts. The Jedi reached their zenith during the Great Peace of the Galactic Republic, while the Sith experienced their largest success millennia earlier as a Sith Empire, and later in the similar Galactic Empire, though by a slightly different underlying political philosophy. The Sith of the Galactic Empire, namely Darth Vader and Sidious, practiced a political strategy called the Rule of Two. In this system, there are only ever two Sith, a powerful master and an avatar of Sith power, and an envious apprentice, and it was expected that the apprentice eventually overthrows the master. In this way, power is greatly consolidated in individual Sith, and the infighting that made the previous Sith Empire so unstable and short-lived could be avoided. In contrast, Darth Krat abolished the Rule of Two and reformed it to the Rule of One. Power is consolidated in one master who dominates all other Sith, who swear obeisance to their master. The Force in military terms is a massive force multiplier on par at times with superweapons. One Dark Lord of the Sith in battle is like an entire battalion of more or more of troops, and by eliminating all or most other Force users, power is much easier to maintain. The Force itself can even be used as a superweapon, as when Darth Nihilus massacred the world of Katar, when Naga Sadow manipulated the plasma from two suns to destroy his enemies, or when Bastila Shan began to turn the tide of the Jedi Civil War in the Republic's favor through the battle meditation. The Sith tend to usurp existing power structures and exercise political influence through realpolitik, their only political ideals being the consolidation of power. In contrast, the Jedi have, at times, tried to be apolitical by practicing an ascetic and spiritual lifestyle, removed in theory from galactic politics and engaging in violence only in self-defense or in the defense of those who are the victims of aggression, regardless of political creed, though their self-appointed position as the de facto guardians of the Republic had been inherently political meta-stance that would later force them to act or not act as conflicts dictated, though they tried to maintain their position as neutral arbitrators rather than enforcers of galactic policy, though in practice this did not always occur. At the beginning of the Pius Day era, they completely broke contact with the Old Republic due to its reprehensibly aggressive behavior. After restoring the Old Republic, the Jedi willingly ceded their political influence, gained from having Grandmaster Bail Dictavius serve as Grand Chancellor, to the standard operating procedures of a democracy. Invariably, as a galaxy is thrown into chaos and bloodshed, the Jedi find themselves lending their considerable powers to the Republic, as the ideals of the Republic have traditionally aligned with those of the Jedi, who have at times gone so far as to swear to defend the Republic. The Jedi made good on their oath during the Mandalorian Wars, the Hyperspace Wars, the Jedi Civil War, and others, often finding their order much scarred by the experience. Though swearing itself to upholding the Republic and peace, the Jedi Order has inadvertently created circumstances which have spoiled both. For example, Darth Vader and Darth Revan, two of the most powerful users of the dark side to ever exist, were trained, created, in effect, by the Jedi Order prior to succumbing to the temptations of the dark side. The Sith themselves, primordial adversaries of the Jedi, are in fact Jedi descendants. The experiments in Darkseid alchemy and forerunners of the later Sith empires were members of the Jedi Order before being exiled for heresy. It is the very act of this exile which caused followers of the Sith philosophy to engage in empire building in the first place.
Astropolitics. We ready to kick this conversation off, guys?
Yeah, let's do it.
So, did that episode make sense? Does the galaxy, do you feel like you know where you are when we talk about Coruscant and Tatooine and the Outer Rim, Mid Rim, all those things?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of dense material, so we're really trying to sum it up to get like a get our bearings in the universe, but yeah. I think we're just getting started into it.
Yeah, it's definitely, it is interesting because it's like it's more of like a history of intergalactic civilization, like when once civilizations start interacting with one another. But even still, it's like the history of the actual galaxy would hypothetically be millions of years, right? Billions of years.
Yeah,
and who knows like what came before that. I don't even know if there's any source material for knowing that.
Well, there is mention, and I didn't do this research, this was Christian, but at some point in Star Wars lore they do is it Goroth Prime?
Yeah,
is that where
the
life,
origin of life
of
yeah,
all
yeah,
life,
yeah. Yeah.
Or is it the origin of life, or is it just the place where life first evolved in the galaxy?
Would it evolve? Be the same thing?
No, because it could evolve.
It could start on another planet as well, like the same process.
Especially just later. What we know about biology now, that if you have a galaxy with aliens, you would definitely have aliens on all kinds of different. And I mean, we'll get into this on the xenobiology, but I mean, the whole idea that all the creatures in Star Wars seem relatively the same and like animals that you might find in the natural world.
Yeah.
With some exceptions, it's a little bit strange because like the idea that DNA is the basis of life is sort of random. I'm sort of going out on a limb because I haven't done any close reading on this or anything, but there are theoretical constructs of other molecule chains like DNA that could work in the same way in terms of building life, self-replicating life that also changes and would be responsive to the pressures of evolution like humans. So it's weird that in a galaxy where maybe life probably evolved spontaneously a bunch of different times, that it looks to us at least like it's still all based on DNA, especially with how much crossbreeding we see that happens between species. Like if there are carbon-based aliens out there, there's no way a carbon-based alien is going to be able to mate with a DNA-based alien, right? Those two systems are just not going to be compatible. But we'll get into that on our xenobiology
episode. I do wonder, though, is it possible that some species could just be like long-lost descendants of other species seeding other planets kind of thing?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any like source material on that.
There's an element of that later on with the... I think they're called the Eternals.
Okay.
But they're a race that starts to seed life across the galaxy. So that could be an example of why there's some similarities.
Yeah.
But I'm also not opposed to the life starting independently, like you were saying, and not being compatible. We just, you know, we haven't looked deep enough into all the different races yet.
But yeah. When
we
do, and there are some really fantastical aliens that you don't get any whiff of in the movies that appear in like the graphic novels and
that's the thing, that there's such a diversity of sentient species within the Star Wars universe. It's like it would be hard to imagine, even if we did have aliens in our galaxy, it would be hard to imagine that diversity. Maybe there is, maybe I'm just like thinking too small, because I know obviously it's hard to comprehend how big the galaxy actually is, but I think
and I wanted to say this for xenobiology, but this is the direction the conversation's going. So do you guys know what the Drake equation is?
Yeah.
So
yeah, explain it just for the audience.
So the Drake equation, and I'm really horrible at math. So excuse me. The broad points of it, though, are it's just an equation that sort of figures out how likely it is that life can evolve on a given planet. And what we use for the variables in that are life on our planet, right? And so then you just extrapolate. So it's like, okay.
How many stars in the galaxy? How many viable planets?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So let's say for the sake of argument that life can only evolve on a planet like Earth. And then you just apply that equation. Well, how many stars are there that are like our sun? Turns out there's a lot, because it's part what's called a main sequence star, and it's one of the most populous forms of stars, and there's, I don't know, millions or billions of those in our galaxy alone, right? And then the Drake equation keeps changing when we learn about the population of planets. Like most stars have at least a gas giant, most of those gas giants got at least a couple moons. So then you just keep applying the math to see how it works.
But essentially based on the Drake equation, it's like sort of the idea is that it's inevitable that there would be other life in the galaxy, and not just in our galaxy, but in many different galaxies. Like it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of sort of when.
Yeah.
You know, like that's sort of the idea of the Drake equation.
And then through the Drake equation, we get to this other idea, which we were sort of talking about. And it has to do with like species like the Eternals that both seed, and then other species, kind of like spoiler alerts for Mass Effect, that come and
destroy
everything, right?
Come and reap, so to speak.
Yeah. So they're like we call that the great filter is the term they talk about it. So there's something. Because when you do math on the Drake equation, we do seem to be suspiciously empty. Like there's been enough time on enough exoplanets like Earth that we should have seen something by now. There would be, even without light speed travel, it's theoretically possible that there could have been many galaxy spanning civilizations. By now. And we obviously don't see that, though.
Yeah, maybe not in our galaxy yet.
It's called the Fermi paradox.
The Fermi paradox. Yeah. That's where I was trying to get
like,
to.
Because of the Drake equation, how prolific life is supposed to be. Yeah, think, we don't
I,
see it.
I
we
think Fermi to... was a buddy of Drake, too. I think they worked in like a lab together.
Well, if you got to be famous, that's, make friends with famous
That might be
people.
Apocryphal, but I really love stories of like scientists who just bust each other's ball. Oh, I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, but going back to like sort of galactic history, another theory that I've sort of wondered about Star Wars is, could life have been started by the Force? Could the Force have had something to do with it? I was actually going to
bring that up. Seems to be the implication.
I think there is a mystical element of it. And they talk about the Force and the wellspring of life, if you recall from our Force episode.
Yeah,
that's specifically what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, does
Yoda even refer to it as that or something? I'm thinking of some sort of movie quote.
Specifically because Qui-Gon, he says, the Force is in all living beings. It's almost like the Force is sort of, quote unquote, they're kind of like DNA, if you will. It's like the sort of building block. It's almost like this allusion to a building block of life. That's just a theory. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the case, but it seems plausible within the world that the Force sort of started in chaos and created order, you know, out of the natural elements.
And yeah, the other thing about it too is the idea of the midichlorians, because they find these midichlorians across multiple species in the blood of.
Yeah, and that as you're saying that, I wondered that too. Like, because Yoda says that the Force is in all things. All things. Rock. So does that mean that there are midichlorians in rocks and sand and trees? Right? Are there midichlorians in everything?
I think the direct quote is actually in living things. So things like rocks I don't think.
But I think he specifically refers to a rock, though.
I think Qui-Gon.
In the movie.
I'm pretty sure someone can fact check us on this, but I'm pretty sure Qui-Gon said all living things.
Yeah.
And perhaps Yoda said...
And by that extension, yes, things like plants would probably have midichlorians in them, but things like rocks, I don't think. I think inert objects don't necessarily have a Force connection, but then that's where you kind of...
What about like the ancient Sith Empire guys though, right? Like they specifically imbued inanimate objects.
Sure. I think you can do that as an external property, but it's not intrinsic to those.
But why wouldn't the
things?
Force be able to do that on its own then without a person? You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure, but humans, or like, not humans, sentients can manipulate the Force in all sorts of ways that were never used prior to existence.
Right. Same way we can breed things. They didn't happen naturally, but we're imposing our will, let's say, on genes. Same way the Sith kind of imposed themselves on midichlorians or the Force and the manipulation of it.
Yeah. That would be my thought.
So the other thing about astropolitics, astrogeography, as we're calling it here, is the sort of diffusion of organization and civilization. So going out from the core worlds are the oldest worlds, right? So they have had the longest time to develop galaxy-spanning civilizations. And you see that with like Coruscant's a core world. That's where humans come from. Humans have obviously done well for themselves in this galaxy. They're everywhere.
Yeah, they're prominent.
They've been what would you call it? The head of many different galactic civilizations. They've sort of been at the helm. And there are lots of other core worlds that I'm just blanking on that were
there's
important.
Places like Alderaan and
Corellia too.
Yeah, Corellia.
They did a lot with hyperspace, like thousands of years. Before.
Yeah, they were one of the
pioneers, and that's another core world. Yeah. Is Kashyyyk a core? No,
no, Kashyyyk is fringe. I think.
And that's the thing I noticed. Just a little thing is, it's funny that at least as the stories are represented in Star Wars lore, with what I'm familiar with, obviously there's so much of it that no one person can have it all in their head. But it really seems like mid-rim worlds just kind of get ignored in storylines for the
Everything
most
goes
place.
To the extremes.
It's always the metropolitan
core
city planet world or the Fringe, Wild West, Jakku or Tatooine or something or Dantooine.
But that's where all the stories are. No one cares about your day-to-day life.
You never have just boring cities with like 150,000 people who are just like...
Going to work and going home.
They've got some industry, some pollution, but it's not that bad.
Nothing is really a global catastrophe. Everything's very local.
Nothing's a global catastrophe. Yeah. They're just doing fine. And maybe that's like most of the galaxy. It's like that.
Well, real life. You only hear on the news about like the war. Exactly. And you hear about, you know, the big chaotic things, but most of us are just living our day to day.
Exactly. It's just those nobles and those blue bloods in the core and those crazy people out
on the fringe.
Out the fringe causing trouble.
I would imagine just within the universe too is like the, while all these things like the Death Star destroying planets and the Empire falling and all this kind of huge political events. There's probably like planets in the Outer Rim who don't even think about it, who maybe don't maybe hear about it.
Like, yeah, it's such a distant thing.
It's almost like an afterthought. Like, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just wondering, like, how much of an effect does it actually have on the like a population. Lot of these populations?
I think they touch on that even in the movies. When in Tatooine, in episode one, when they get there and they talk about like all these legislation against slavery, for example, and I believe Shmi Skywalker says like the Republic doesn't exist out here, right? Like not even their money doesn't even qualify out there, even though technically they fall under their jurisdiction.
Were they under the jurisdiction?
It's complicated because you have things like hut space that kind of intersect with the kinda, political.
What we're talking about now with like their money not working really reminds me of like Europe or something. You know what I mean? Where they've got like, they've got the euro, but then they've also got their individual
local currencies.
And then some countries won't take the local currency of other countries and some will. And it's all very confusing.
Yeah.
And I imagine that times a million.
For every planet.
every planet. And also bringing this up with like people on the outer rims of the galaxy, not knowing exactly what's going on is... You wonder how much there is like kind of a monoculture that's penetrated throughout the galaxy. Like, are there populated worlds in this galaxy that have civilizations on them that just haven't reached hyperspace, or have they pretty much settled everything that had sentience on
it? I'm glad you brought that up. That's literally where I wanted to go next, is kind of like the geopolitical aspect.
Yeah.
And there's like a colonial component too that we'll dive into in a sec, but mostly to stay on track with your question there. One of the biggest things with Star Wars that I love is there is a general monoculture, but there are definitely strong...
It's very diverse, though.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, even like you take the people of the Naboo, for example, they have a very distinct look and style compared to the other civilizations, whatever you may think of it, but they're very embedded with the Senate and with the Republic, right? So, and every planet you find this, even like big, like mishmash kind of planets, like Tatooine, a spaceport, you look around and people have very distinct cultural.
Interesting how distinct they are from each other too. Like, you don't, if you go into, let's say, a youth hostel in a central European country like Germany or something, where there's going to be a lot of people traveling there from all over the world. It's like you look at them, but they could basically all be from the same city. Like nobody looks that different from each other, even in what they're wearing. You know what I mean? Like,
true.
They're all wearing denim. They're all
right.
They've all got iPhones. They've all got Nike hoodies.
Yeah, but like in the Star Wars universe, it's as if they would all wear their own traditional wear. So imagine you walk into a hostel and someone's wearing like a Cossack outfit who's like a Russian, and then you'll find like someone wearing a traditional Polish outfit.
But then it's like, wait a minute, you guys have had hyperspace technology for like 20,000 years. What do you mean your traditional wear? You have no traditional wear.
So there are even,
is like the Nabooian stuff that old? Or do people just not travel that much?
It depends planet to planet. Some planets, like Coruscant, for example, probably looks nothing like Coruscant looked.
Yeah. But Coruscant would be such a multicultural.
Is it Coruscant, Corazant, or Coruscant?
Coruscant.
We could probably do a whole episode on how to pronounce Star Wars names. I'm just going to say it the way I say it.
Yeah, but anyways, like...
And again, and I just noticed this now, we see that very on-the-nose Star Wars naming, Corazons, because it's in the galactic core.
Oh, there's more of that that's going to come up much later.
Darth Vader, because he's an invader.
Actually, there's an interesting thing about the Darth Vader thing. I'm going to save it for a language episode, but it's not what you think.
Vader, also a great, really fat professional wrestler from like the 80s and 90s.
Well, there's also an old religion called the Vedas.
Yeah. But Vader, he was really fat, and he did backflips off the top rope, which is why I liked him.
Yeah.
Vader's also a decent death metal band. Not about Star Wars, though.
They better pay us for that ad.
Okay.
I'm gonna bite the bait here. So I believe it's Dutch. Vader actually means father, And as George Lucas himself said that he used the term. So he said Darth.
It sounds like a good enough menacing name.
Right, exactly. Yeah. He said
he's
Darth.
He's worse than J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, again, you'll be surprised. I'm like I said, we're going to do a whole episode on that stuff. And it's really interesting.
That etymology of Star Wars names, that could be a really good episode.
Yeah, and we like I want to dive into so much of it. But just to give it away, at least for this one, is Vader comes from father in Dutch. And essentially, it's Dark Father is what Lucas was trying to convey with Darth Vader. But the Sith naming schemes obviously start to adopt a very, like, they have words that are shared. Like, yes, Vader can sound like Invader. Sidious is like Insidious. You know, Maul is like a brutish weapon.
Nihilus from exactly. Nihilism.
So it starts to take that trend, but Lucas himself has stated what the background to Vader's name was.
I do like it, though, because all the Star Wars names sound great.
I just think...
When you say them, they're great to say.
Yeah, and that's actually another thing. We'll save it for the etymology episode, because I could go on for hours about it. But just before I go there, I just wonder what it sounds like to the Dutch when they first listen to Star Wars. It's a very on-the-nose, the bad guy's named Father.
Another thing, I know another thing that's influential within astropolitics is the spice trade.
Yes.
And I was wondering... If Lucas had any sort of like
addictions, secret addictions.
Yeah. Well, an allusion to, because Frank Herbert's Dune.
I knew exactly where your
minds were.
And Tatooine, hello.
Yeah, and I looked it up, and Dune was written in 65, so it was obviously predated.
I think Lucas has gone on record and said that he read Dune before writing
so Star
Wars,
like an influence.
And it definitely. Influenced him.
Yeah. Even like the Sarlacc pit on Tatooine.
Yes.
The planet Tatooine. A lot of it is almost Dune-like. You know.
It's not almost Dune-like. Yeah. The sand people. The Fremen. Right.
There's a lot of these like very similar things that are, and I love Dune too myself. Yeah. But I haven't
the
read
Dune
the book
movie,
in years.
Underrated.
Totally underrated.
Well, again, for a later episode, we'll do a pop culture references one for Star Wars.
And also, here's another pop culture Dune connection. Did you guys know that David Lynch was taken out to lunch by George Lucas in his Lamborghini, and Lucas wanted him to direct Empire Strikes Back? But David Lynch passed on it. I don't know if you guys know David Lynch.
No, who's that?
He directed Dune. And he's also a famous horror and sort of surrealist movie director. He also did The Elephant Man.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And Blue Velvet. Hmm. I can't believe I'm blanking on the name of this show. Come Fire Walk With Me. Am I ringing any bells? No. Kyle MacLachlan's in it. Twin Peaks. No. You guys don't know Twin Peaks?
Okay. I'm familiar with Twin Peaks. I'm not like a big fan or anything.
He was the creative mind and director of most of the Twin Peaks.
I like the original Twin Peaks.
Yeah. The new one.
Oh, and the new one. Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And he almost directed Strikes Back.
And he almost directed Empire Strikes Back. And he passed on it. And he went and did Dune. Instead, basically.
The best movie of them all, in my opinion.
What would have happened?
Yeah. Anyways, go ahead, Christian.
I just wanted to bring back the colonial discussion.
Yeah.
Just for a quick second. When you were mentioning earlier about how like things are kind of centralized in the core worlds.
Yeah.
That does reflect kind of a colonial idea of like Europe being the center of like Western civilization and things, and expanding outwards and seeing everything as like as new as they encounter, right? North Americas are new to us,
it's
right?
The frontier.
Exactly. But they completely disregard like indigenous populations. And the same kind of ideas in Star Wars where you're saying like, oh, you know, they would have been the oldest cultures in the core worlds, but that's not necessarily true, especially
if
life.
That's definitely not true.
Like the
obviously.
Wookiees, for example, like evolved on their planet. They're one of the first sentient species, not the first, but one of the first earliest groups. They have a fully developed culture and everything by the time they make contact with the greater galactic, I don't know what to call it, republic or civilizations. Yeah. So that's the thing, is like Star Wars was always expanding, and colonialism plays a big part in the early battles of the galaxy, because you have empires and like republics fighting each other And they also have them fighting locals. And there's,
yeah, you also have like first contact type conflicts.
Yeah, that happen repeatedly.
Repeatedly happen. Yeah.
So just something that I wanted to touch on because you brought it up earlier.
And that was something when I was writing this, actually. I don't know if you guys have ever read Guns, Germs, and Steel.
I've heard of it. Yeah, it sounds like a very interesting book.
It's super good. But yeah. The point is that really gives you the scale of just total human annihilation that went on just this one time with us moving over to with Europeans, not us, going to settling the Americas, like how many populations were devastated.
Yeah,
and I was thinking, as species were developing galactic travel, this pattern that's in Guns, Germs, and Steel would have happened thousands of times, maybe.
Yeah,
we're talking trillions of people dying of like colds and just like random germs from Twi'lek.
Yeah, and they're just like footnotes in the historical exactly. records, right? We this contacted
civilization
a planet.
Died of toe fungus from the Hots.
Yeah,
and they just disappeared. We don't know why.
They just disappeared.
But it's free real estate.
So. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It is pretty interesting. I do wonder too, like, it's probably, especially like in like the original movies and like the sort of New Republic, you're getting like a more of a conceptualization of sort of, what do you call humanoid rights or sentient life rights? Whereas you could imagine that throughout galactic history, there's a lot of xenophobia, and basically any species that isn't your species is you can just like annihilate, enslave, and so on and so forth.
You would expect that to happen, but it's surprising, even as I've been reading the Empire comic book series, which does sort of all the interstitial stuff. Basically, it fills in the gaps in the first trilogy.
Yeah.
So like all the years between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back and Empire Strikes Back and stuff. And so it gets a lot, obviously it's called Empire, into the Empire and its inner workings. And like the racism thing isn't really
that. It doesn't come up that often.
Come up that often.
Yeah, but I'm saying not in like that era, but I'm saying in like eras past. Is there not any?
I think we can.
There are examples
like genocides, or
yeah, it happens.
Genocide, but that's almost always tactical. You know what I mean? Like,
it's not because they hate you because of your race.
Yeah,
they,
it's not
they
hate want you because of your race.
Planet
you're just,
or your
you're just in the way, or you made Vader mad, so he's got to blow you up.
Yeah, there is. There are elements of xenophobia that come up intermittently, and things of like you have the Crusade eras during the early Galactic Republic.
But was that even xenophobia, or was that just...
No, it was straight up xenophobia.
It was.
And then you have
humans
elements
against
and the Mandalorians are pretty xenophobic.
They're not actually.
They're multicultural.
They are
right?
very multicultural.
Yeah. Really?
They do end up committing genocide quite frequently.
Yeah,
but
that's,
they
that
are
was
surprisingly
sort of my
again.
That's
like
just
Sam
of their
was saying,
laissez-faire attitude on life.
Right. Exactly. Sam was right on the nose with that. Where like they commit genocide a lot, but it was tactical.
It's
it
not.
Was less,
it's not based out of hate.
Yeah. No. And they are very like
it's
open.
It's a
to
progressive
other species
form of genocide.
The best kind.
We might be killing your whole race, but we're respecting your rights while we do it. You're individuals and you have a beautiful culture. It has to go away. Now.
The Empire, too, exhibits very strong xenophobic sentiments as well. Yeah. So it does come up, but I would say things like in the Republic. I mean, there's elements of other aliens being racist to each other, too.
I'm really reading it, too, because me and Christian have had a little bit of a debate about this in writing the episodes. But I'm trying to get, like, specific policy details about what those xenophobic tendencies were for the Empire, but they definitely had alien officers and stuff. It doesn't seem like there was an official no non-humans allowed.
Yeah, it's not. I like to kind of draw comparisons more to the southern states during like Jim Crow era, where things like might have been legislated that they're not racist, but they kind of were, right? Like it.
Maybe this is the flip side of that, though.
Right.
It's not legislated,
but they are. Right, exactly.
But they are, in fact, racist.
Yeah, exactly. So there are, of course, you have like admirals like Thrawn who achieve a certain level of like prestige even in their ranks, despite being aliens.
Yeah. The Empire seems just to be very human-centric.
Human-centric is the way I would put it.
My theory is that some Imperial accountant at some point, as Palpatine was building his Stormtrooper Corps, accidentally put a few extra zeros on how many sets of Stormtrooper armor he ordered, and they just had like millions of sets of Stormtrooper armor that could only fit humans.
Write a short story, Sam.
So that's why it was just an accounting
created
error.
The policy. Yeah.
I guess it's only humans now.
And there are even aliens that do wear Stormtrooper armor. They're very interesting. They look very cool.
I just saw a comic book cover of an alien taking off a helmet.
Yeah. You know? So it does happen. It's not exclusive, but they're definitely human centric is how
and,
I would.
I mean, the whole galaxy is sort of anthropocentric, right?
Like, yes. Definitely more human looking aliens have preference.
I've got a whole master's thesis brewing in this about evolution and why we see that, which will be really interesting. But think about this. Even the species who aren't necessarily humanoid, they almost always have like binocular vision.
And a mouth and a nose and hands.
And I wasn't even going to say mouth and nose, but they have manipulative appendages, right? Yeah. Okay. They have things that
can grasp.
But like even that, like the Hutts or something. They have all those.
Or Soto Vyosk Bask, is that his name? He's from...
I'm going to go ahead and say yes. That is his name.
I'm going to say yes. He's sort of like a crustacean-looking old Jedi master from like the Old Republic era.
Yeah.
And he has like some tentacles and some claws, but like still basically going into that anthropoid body plan where he's got forward-facing vision and appendages and something that can make sound and speech, right?
I'm gonna 50-50 say that's probably attributed to the limitations of of movie magic at the time.
How dare you? I don't even know what a movie is. This is real.
But yeah, just like Star Trek, right? Everything happens to look humanoid because it's really cheap to slap some wrinkles on someone's face and call them an alien.
Oh my god.
now one thing, and I don't know if you guys came across this in your travels, one thing I'm sort of wondering why it hasn't had like much of an influence on astropolitics or galactic history is any kind of AI or robotic intelligence.
I've been thinking about this a lot too.
Yeah. Like, why is it that even though it seems to be there's lots of AIs within the Star Wars universe, none of them band together to make a robot army.
So, but they do actually.
Okay. And yeah. But that's why I'm asking. Have you come across?
Do we even know that like most of the robots are in AIs?
Fact AI. Yeah, they may not be AI.
So there's
in
a couple
the strictest
of
sense.
Things
yeah, there's
to
a couple of
unpack there. Yeah. The first thing is the nature of AI. Are they truly artificial intelligence, or are they just very highly programmed?
Right.
To be algorithmic, you know, to appear as
that,
if
that was sort of my assumption because I'm sure there's some arcane storyline somewhere in the Star Wars lore about this. But for the most part, you don't see droids really behaving like people. Almost ever.
Yeah, and they do fall back on programming. They even admit to it, right? Yeah. They say, I'm programmed for this, I'm programmed
for that. And they're perfectly happy
to do
what they're
things.
Programmed to do.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of the Rick and Morty with the robot.
Except for like
butter.
R2. R2-D2 is probably ironically the most human robot in the Star Wars.
Despite, or sentient.
Yeah. There are whole storylines that follow things like, and then we'll again dive into it later more in depth, but things like IG-88, who does gain sentience and actually tries to...
And Forlome as well.
Yeah.
And you know Forlome.
And
I had that action figure when I was a kid. Very sad when my dog got to him. Shoot him up.
Eaten by a Wookiee.
Yeah.
And then and there's even incidences of droid rebellions that we'll delve into and kind of we'll unpack those questions there. But it's definitely something to keep in the back of your mind. You know, are there ethics around treating the AI the way that they are treated in Star Wars too, right?
And circling back to our Dune conversation, in Dune, Frank Herbert handled this, I think, very well, is that question would naturally come up in a property like Dune where you have all this super hyper advanced technology and it's like, where are the AIs? Well, there was this big thing called the Bootlerian Jihad in Dune where there was a huge like a galaxy spanning war of humans against thinking machines, and then they actually made it illegal to develop any sort of AI whatsoever. So like even basic stuff, computations, they ended up creating like a whole new class of people called Mentats, right? To do all of that hyperdrive. But there's nothing in that in Star Wars that I know of, but maybe this storyline you're talking about, Christian, is similar to the Bularian Jihad.
Yeah, the weird thing about the droid rebellions is they're very like underplayed, I think.
Yeah.
They get quashed pretty quickly and they're very like localized. But you would think, yes, it would be pretty devastating to have all your AI go rogue in a galaxy.
And this goes back to our slavery.
Well, you would think, too, that like an AI army or civilization would be like incredibly effective and powerful.
And efficient.
Yeah.
It could be the limitations of programming. It could be like they are ghosts in their programming that caused these like kind of errant behaviors. And they're not necessarily... operating at an optimal capacity.
They're just like flawed.
That is something that comes up periodically throughout the lore is wiping the memories of droids frequently to prevent errors.
Right.
So there is sort of a hint. And again, with R2, the reason he's like so defiant and has such an attitude.
Because he never gets his memory wiped.
It's because he never gets his memory wiped.
Yeah.
So maybe there is a potential.
Yeah, but if you let that happen for long enough, could like R2 could hypothetically take over the Death Star. He could just plug himself in and be like.
So that's literally one of the plot points. IG-88 tries to hijack.
Yeah, he tries.
He becomes
the
Death Star.
He tries to build.
Oh, like does a, he? Yeah. Okay.
So again, well, I hate to get too far into it because then it starts its own episode and stuff, but I was trying to
ask just more in context of like actual astral politics and do they have
like
any
droid
on,
and droid rights and things like that will definitely come
and,
up as a
and something in our slavery back and forths me and Christian have been having, like, why is slavery such a big thing when you've clearly got
robots,
got the ability to build some pretty sweet robots.
Totally.
My theory is just that much like now, robots are just prohibitively expensive. And it's like robots are maybe like cars. Maybe your average servo droid R2 unit, 3PO unit is like the expense of a car, right? Like obviously lots of people have cars. Cars are ubiquitous on our planet. But I don't think even close to the majority of human beings own a car.
No, especially if you look at population concentrations like in India and Asia, where even owning a car is just like impractical.
Exactly. So I kind of figure that answers that part is made, but then they've been around for thousands of years, so
you'd think they'd be able to scale droid production.
Another theory I have about that astropolitics of Star Wars, though, is it's about the wars thing, and this is wrapping this whole episode up in a nice little bow. But wars, while they do stimulate a lot of innovation and economic growth, obviously they also have the flip side of
destruction and devastation.
And
they're actually very destructive. Yeah,
they're actually very destructive. So I kind of think, given how many galaxy-spanning wars there have been, maybe like the resources just haven't been put into those kinds of technologies
because they are
diverted to warfare.
And a lot of the, obviously there's like the droid army and all that stuff, like where droids are actually weapons of war, not necessarily just
servants.
Yeah,
I think that's the biggest thing that I just delving into the history of it all is it's called Star Wars for a reason, and war is definitely a central turning motive of the galaxy. It comes back repeatedly, often, and is pretty destructive in a lot of the storyline.
But it's productive for us because it gives
us content,
something to take time away from our wives on a Friday night to talk about.
Exactly. Well, on that note, thanks for listening. May the Force be with you.
For the Emperor.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Why, you stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder!
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to give the show a 5-star rating and review.
and give us a follow on social media. This episode was produced and edited by me, Jordan Swaim, written and directed by Christian Lutz and Sam Swaim. All original music was scored and recorded by my music project. Farewell to Shadowland.
Thanks for flying with us. We are interested to hear from you. You can reach us at starlorespodcast@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts, comments, or corrections. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating, review, and subscribe. You can also help us out through our Patreon at The Star Lores Podcast. Find us on Instagram, The Star Lores Podcast, on Facebook at The Star Lores Podcast, on Twitter at The Star Lores Podcast, and on YouTube, Star Lores Podcast. We'll catch you next time.